everyone?
Great.
Good. Everyone hear me?
Yeah.
Okay. My name is Evelyn Torres, and I work for the AIDS Activities Coordinating Office, better known as AICO, and I'm the Client Services Manager there. And for those of you who are familiar with AICO, we provide or fund services through a network of providers for people with HIV or at risk of HIV disease. So I'm very happy to be here to moderate this workshop today. It's a very important one. Workshop is Housing 101, Homelessness and HIV, and it's the first of several workshops on housing throughout the day as it tends to lay out the scope of the problem in Philadelphia, what resources are available, how HIV and homelessness are correlated, and provide really some personal perspectives on the whole issue of homelessness. I'm going to go ahead and introduce our speakers all at once, get the formalities out of the way. I'm going to introduce them in terms of how they appear or how they're going to speak. So our first speaker is Leticia Ejea Hinton. Letty, as she is known to many of us, she's back there. Well, Letty's the one who kicked me off the table, just to let you know, okay? Letty received her Bachelor of Science in Psychology from Chestnut Hill College, Master's in Public Administration from Antioch College, and Master's in Social Work from the University of Pennsylvania. Letty has worked in social services for 27 years, 22 of those years in homeless service. She has an extensive background in the field of social services. Her early years started with the Alcohol Highway Safety Program and Crime Prevention Program. Her governmental experience began in Philadelphia, in the Philadelphia prison system. She then moved on to the Department of Human Services, Children and Youth Division, and later Adult Services, OESS, is what now is known as the Office of Supporting Housing, where she's the current Deputy Director of Operations. Letty has worked for 22 years, has reflected her strong belief that all homeless individuals be treated with dignity and respect. She's going to be providing us with the overview of housing and homelessness in Philadelphia. She'll be followed by Mr. Kenneth Robinson. Ken Robinson holds both a Master of Education in Counseling and a Master of Arts in Spanish. He has worked in social services for almost 20 years, and all of his work has been with indigent and or disenfranchised population. Ken moved to New York City in early 2003 to start the Transgender Transitional Housing Program for Housing Works Incorporated. In 2005, he was promoted to Vice President of Housing Operation, and he now oversees, in addition to the Transgender Transitional Housing Program, the Women's Transitional Housing Program, the Staten Island Housing Program, and the Stand Up Harlem House. All these programs provide housing and supportive services to formerly homeless New Yorkers living with HIV. Ken is going to be addressing the correlation between HIV and homelessness and giving us a national perspective of this problem. Last but not least is Clifford A. Williams. Clifford A. Williams is here to share with us his valuable consumer's perspective. He's a representative of today's baby boomer generation. In Cliff's own word, he represents the homeless male population with HIV. He represents Project Teach and Teach Outside Graduates. That's a program of Philadelphia Fight. He is an AIDS activist and writer. He also represents fathers, sons, brothers, uncles with HIV, and feels that everyone has a valid opinion. These are our speakers. I think it's going to be very exciting today. Please give them a hand. And Letty's going to start it off. Welcome, Letty.
Good morning, everybody.
Good morning.
You guys don't mind if I stand up, do you? And my sidekick over there is Kevin Brazil. He's the Assistant Deputy Director of Operations. So he gets to do the important stuff. It's like move the slides when I'm ready to move on. What I wanted to do a little, I'm sorry, guys, my back is to you guys. I wanted to do, at least what I was asked to do, was to do a presentation, a basic presentation on homelessness 101, that really had more to do in my mind of what are some of the misperceptions that people have of people who are homeless or who they think the population is. So I'm starting with our first slide, just asking a simple question. You see a little guy going up and down, and you know, what is homelessness? Who are the homeless? And what we see versus what exists. And you know, the question for me, I have a tendency to be a little interactive. I hate preaching to people, is who do you think the homeless are? Answer, somebody.
People that have, like, lost their jobs.
People who lost their jobs, okay, anybody? Anybody else? I can't hear. I'm sorry. Nobody else? Go ahead, sir. Older, 40, dad, 40 or 50, dad. I'm going to tell you how old I am. 40 or 50, guys. All right, I'm like 29, okay? Well, I think what's important to understand is that we need to ask ourselves, who are the homeless, and who are the homeless in the city of Philadelphia in particular? I'm originally from New York as well, and I remember the homeless being folks on the Bowery. So, you know, the Bowery doesn't exist anymore. You can't even afford to live there anymore. Next, please. So this picture is what usually people think homeless people are. Wouldn't we agree? I mean, when people see, if you're downtown and you're walking on Broad Street near JFK, for example, or you're just walking in different parts of the city, particularly Center City, this is what people usually think homeless people are. So we have to kind of think about what our perception is. Perception is what we believe and who we think the homeless are. That's what perception is. And are we, my question to all of you is, are we viewing the homeless from the wrong angle? Because I think that part of what happens, if there's a child involved, there's lots of money coming to provide services to children, correct? But if there's an adult male that looks like a homeless person, you don't even have to be homeless, you just have a bad day. People will cross the street. So think about that. Next, please. So my next question to you is, what do you see? Can somebody tell me what they see up there? And if you've done this exercise, don't tell. Leave it away. Okay? So what do you see?
Two faces.
Two faces. Anybody else see anybody, anything else?
A stand.
A gas.
Somebody sees a stand. What else?
Mini gas.
Anything else? A vase. Okay. Or what else?
Bird bath.
It could be a bird bath. So what this says is that if you look at it, yeah, you're right. I do see the faces. You see the faces inside there. You could see a vase. Somebody made it a bird bath. I thought it was a stand. I thought you could put flowers on top of it. So you have to think about homelessness the same way. Next slide, please. What do you see? Somebody saw an old woman. Anybody else see anything? Squint them eyes now. Somebody, right. Does everybody see the young lady? Can you see the young lady? Hold on.
Far
along. Okay, this is the young lady. Look. From here to here, right? She has fur. But the old lady has a big nose. See her mouth? All right. So my point in presenting these particular slides to you is that it's all about perception. It really is about perception. It's about who we think the homeless are. Now, I'd like you to just look at each other. Look at somebody. Say hi. Say hi to everybody.
Hi.
All right. Guess what? You guys could be the homeless. I could be the homeless. I actually experienced homelessness as a kid in New York City when it wasn't so nice. It's a little nicer now, but when I was a kid in New York. And people would say, you've been homeless? Yeah, I sure have, as a kid. So, you know, you have to really think about when you have an attitude, when you're thinking about who homeless people are, whether you want to be a part of the community and help people, you have to think about who really are the homeless. And I'm going to share with you. The McKinney-Vento Act, this is an act that really kind of covers a lot of the funding that we get for homelessness in the city of Philadelphia and actually nationally. And this is the general definition of a homeless individual within the federal government has provided, and it talks about someone who lives in a residence that's public or private, that's not designated for sleeping, so that could be like an airport, right, or someplace like that, living in motels, hotels, trailers, parks, camping grounds. Now, around here, I don't think we have a lot of camping grounds, but living in emergency or transitional housing. I'm responsible for the emergency housing part of it, so that's who's considered homeless. A primary nighttime residence that is public or private, living in cars, parks, public spaces, abandoned buildings, substandard housing, etc. And substandard housing could be anything from housing that's abandoned housing. You know how Philly is really, which is what I like about Philly, and people don't really recognize the blessing of living in Philly, is that where I grew up, I always lived in these big apartment buildings. My family lived in projects when when fathers could live in projects. So, you know, you had all of that stuff. I always lived in an apartment building, so you could have one floor with multiple families had their own apartments, and they lived in their apartments on this one floor. In Philly, you could be poor and live in a house. That was incredible to me. So the first time I lived in a real house that we owned was here in Philly. You can actually afford housing here, and that was astounding to me. Next, please. I wanted to share national data. It's estimated that about 1.5 million Americans will experience homelessness in 2009 and 2010. And some of that, yes, does have to do with the housing crisis and the market, and I know you've been paying attention to the news, so you know what that's about. Okay. But in addition to that, there are other people who are experiencing homelessness on an everyday basis. So that means that the problem has gotten much more complicated and bigger. The primary contributor, the reason that a lot of people are homeless, has to do with lack of affordable housing. Now, yes, it is true that there are other contributors, people who don't have good jobs, you know, people who can't afford health care. If you have something that goes wrong and you have some major illness that comes up and you can't, you're not eligible for welfare or Medicare, whatever you want to call it, you're going to go into crisis. Or you could be working a full-time job, not have adequate coverage, and something happen, and that can take you over the edge. Domestic violence, we in our system have a lot of households, not just women. People think domestic violence is just for women. It's women who have children as well as men. Mental health is a big one, substance abuse, and institutional discharge without appropriate planning. That could be, institutional discharge could be anywhere from a prison to a drug and alcohol program to you name it. And of course, I kind of said again, the economic crisis in the housing market. So there are a lot of reasons, and there are even more reasons as to why people experience homelessness that we're not even aware of. Our local data has to do with Philly. We are estimating that approximately about 3,500 individuals are homeless in Philadelphia. 42% of those people in Philadelphia are kids. They're children. And so they're about, the persons that are under 18 are the most common users of shelter because we have a lot of kids in our system. And we serve approximately about 2,800 people nightly. And during the winter, it increases to about 3,200 people. So that does not cover people who necessarily are living in their cars and other hidden places that we're not aware of. I know that there's an area in up on Aramingo Avenue, up under 95. There's an area up there where I've been told that there are complete households living up there. So we do have a lot of homeless in the city of Philadelphia. But as compared to New York, our problem is small. Next, please. In Philadelphia County, this was the poverty rate. We know that poverty has a lot to do with homelessness. Nationally, it's 13%. In Pennsylvania, it's 11.6%. And in Philadelphia, it's 23.8%. That's high. The median income, based on the census, in Philadelphia is $35,365. National is $50,740. So Philadelphia has the seventh lowest median income of all counties and places with populations of 250,000 people that are struggling. So what we know about homelessness, we know that in Philadelphia it disproportionately affects African Americans, right? That's 80% of the population, 12% are white, 5% are Hispanic, and then we have a small percentage of other. That would include Asian and a variety of other groups. There's been an 8% increase in shelter use over the last 3 years. Okay. That Philadelphia, our total, which is high because our total census is about 3,121. So that's pretty high. And last night, or the night that I did this, it was a total census of about 2,841. And family members were 1,299. So family members, we're talking about moms with heads of house with children. The average family size is 2.78, and the average length of stay in our system is about 123 days or 4 months. And with families, I think we've kind of noted, Kev, right, that it's gotten longer. We know that some families will stay 6 months, some up to a year. We've even discovered there's a small percentage of single adult men in our system that have been in our system over 2 years. So we've become almost, even though we're trying to prevent it, a permanent housing option. Next, please. We also know that there could be, when I ask you to look at each other, we know that many of us are living check to check. So we know that one crisis, one thing could happen. It could be a small increase in the rent. It could be the utilities. Now, I know the utilities are killing me. So the utilities going up, right? It could be the tax. It could be anything that could happen. And we know that that could put anybody over the edge. About 23.8% are living below the federal poverty line. And in Philadelphia County, what we really need to think about, we know that the living wage or current minimum wage is $7.15. To be able to make it, what we really need is called the living wage. Living wage would be for $14.15 an hour to afford a studio apartment. That's what you'd have to earn. $16.19 to afford one bedroom, and $19.33 an hour, or $40,000, a little bit more than $40,000 a year to afford a two-bedroom apartment. And we know that a lot of people aren't making that kind of money. Right. And on welfare, you definitely can't do it. So we know the current minimum wage is $7.15. So in order to be able to live off of $7.15, you'd have to pay a rent of at least $3.72 a month. And we know that it's very difficult to find anything that's decent, right, at that cost. The current monthly Social Security income payment is $674. To be able to afford a unit with SSI income, you need like $202 because you got to eat and you got to do all those other things. And so when you're thinking about living out there, it's not just about getting a roof over your head. It's about everything that's involved in trying to make it day to day. We know that there's a big gap. That one of the crucial issues in Philadelphia is being able to afford housing in Philly. And we've seen all this development, all these condos, all this stuff, right? But we also know that PHA, right, has been building a lot of different housing out there. You're seeing all this really nice looking housing. It's really very nice housing. So, but we know that there's a large gap between the income and cost of living. So we estimated in 2003, and it hasn't changed based on the census and stuff, that we need like about 60,000 units of affordable housing to be able to fill the housing gap in Philly. I ain't got it in my pocket, but, you know. So the last thing that I wanted to do was just to show you what the Office of Supportive Housing or the City of Philadelphia is doing about some of the issues that we're facing regarding housing. What we directly provide right now, and some of you may be familiar with, is we have a direct central intake. We serve about 15,000 individuals annually. It's a lot of people because we're not a big system. We have an emergency relocations unit that serves about 2,000 households annually. This is a unit that is under our purview, that when there's a fire out there somewhere and they need somebody to intercede, this is the group that is often attached with Red Cross. Red Cross might provide the 30 days housing, but after the 30 days of housing, if they need additional assistance, we're responsible for doing. We have a protective services unit that a lot of people don't know anything about. We serve 18 to 59-year-olds to keep them living in their households. These are people who have some pretty serious disabilities, but with some assistance would need to be living in the household. We have a homemaker program, but these are the people that, you know what DHS is for kids? This is kind of like the DHS for people, older people. So if you know someone who is being their money's being taken by family members, or they're being abused, this unit, we are responsible. And then we have Riverview, or personal care boarding home, and we serve about 214 people within the Riverview homes, and a lot of people may not realize. Contracted for emergency housing, we contract for 2,933 emergency shelter beds. And so compared to other cities, it's not a huge system, but for us, it's a pretty sizable one. So we have 13 family shelters and 12 shelters for individuals, so single adults, which is single adult sites for single males and single female sites. We try not to keep them together. In development and operations, we have 847 permanent housing units. That includes 160 for chronic homeless individuals. And chronic homeless people are the people that you often see downtown that people step over on the grate. Those are our chronic homeless. clients before. People who've been based on the federal HUD regulation have been in our system over, I think, three times and over a three-year period or four-year period. We have 543 transitional housing units. We have domestic violence, emergency housing beds, it's 100, a hotline, and about 22 units of transitional housing that primarily focuses on families, but we do have transitional housing for single adult women and men. Kevin actually was kind enough to do this for us. I wanted to see if we could have at least a snapshot of what our shelter census has looked over three and a half years. So you can see that even with what's been going on, it's kind of been, there have been a few drops in it, but it's kind of been stable. So while we have many strategies to serve people, we have more people that are coming in or in need of our services than we're able actually to provide. But I thought that would be a good one that would give you a sense. And you do have it in your handout, if you can see it. The other thing I wanted to at least provide, because I knew that this was HIV AIDS conference, was to kind of show you what units we have that actually targets the population, people who are either HIV positive or have AIDS. And so we have permanent supportive housing programs with these 7 providers. And then, last but not least, when Mayor Nutter came into office, prior to Mayor Nutter, there was what's called a 10-year plan to end homelessness, which some of you may be aware of. That plan was recalibrated. We have the Mayor's Homeless Initiative as well. This was, before we get to that, the Mayor's Homeless Initiative, when he came into office, he indicated to us that he was really committed to helping us deal with this whole issue of homelessness in the city of Philadelphia. And so what we were able to do was to provide what we're to call cafes. We got this idea from Columbus, Ohio. No, it wasn't Columbus, Ohio. It was Denver, Colorado. And what they are is these places for people who will not come in through traditional shelter. They can actually get a hot cup of soup, sandwich overnight rather than freeze and die on the streets. And actually people really like them and come in. So we were able to get 2 additional cafes year round. The other thing that was done was we created a total of about 75 new low demand housing opportunities. So that means low demand means that there's a population of people who are homeless who cannot deal with the structure of our traditional shelters or the requirements. So we've tried to create opportunities for them. We've had some chronic homeless drug treatment programs that have been created, and then there's been a creation of some permanent and subsidized housing opportunities. The Homeless Prevention and Rapid Housing Initiative is the new money that you may have heard something about, the economic recovery dollars that President Obama has signed. We are now in the process of designing a program that's going to do 3 things for us. Homeless prevention, which is we'll be able to give stipends or shallow subsidies to people who are living in the community that if they got, let's say for some reason something happens in their job and their hours got cut this month, but they need a little help to keep the rent going, we may give them a month, 2 months to keep them where they are, and they'll be able to pay the rent moving forward. So that's homeless prevention, or you needed assistance with utilities because you had a bad month or something, you couldn't pay utilities. We think it's really cheaper to keep you in the community and allow you to stay in your communities rather than come into shelter. We do shelter diversion that will be done at the front door. These are people who are coming into shelter who believe they need to be in a shelter, but we discover that they can go back home, for example. So we will be, kind of do that now, but we'll be talking to family members or wherever they're staying to see if we can buy them more time while we're coming up with a strategy. And then we have rapid rehousing. Rapid rehousing will be for people who are in shelter. These are people that we want to rapidly rehouse and get them into the community, get them into housing. So it's kind of exciting for us because this is the first time in my history of working with homeless services that we actually got some money to help us shut down our front door almost and redesign what we're doing. And this is why I was kind of jumping the gun here. The mayor of Philadelphia, we've been working with a couple of mayors on the 10-year plan to end homelessness. This, during this administration, it was recalibrated, which basically means they restructured it. It was announced on May 28th, and the biggest, or the goals that are focused on is targeting individuals and families, focusing on prevention and chronic homelessness on the street. So some of what you've seen throughout the presentation has been that focus. And last but not least, you have a copy of this. These are the strategic goals that we're focusing on. You know, opening the back door, closing the front door, all of those things. So you can read those at your leisure. Okay. So I hope that this was helpful and gave some information. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, we're going to hold questions to the end so that we have an opportunity for all our speakers to talk to you all. Again, I'd like to introduce Kenneth Robinson from Housing Works Incorporated in New York City. Welcome.
Good morning, everybody. I'm really happy to be here. I used to live in northern Delaware and came up here all the time, and actually just happened to be here this weekend. I came down for my birthday. Feels good to be here again. I just love the city. Happy to be here. So I am with Housing Works. I was a little scared to admit that after the keynote. Charles was very provocative, and I love him for that. I'm not going to repeat anything that he said. I think he said it all very well. But I think, one thing that we should keep in mind is that we can love our leaders and hold them accountable at the same time. You know, we can do both those things. So I need to, I'm kind of technologically impaired here, but I need to get to my presentation really quickly. So I'm basically going to talk about in two parts. I'm going to talk about, I am the Vice President of Housing for Housing Works. And so I'm going to talk about our housing stock at Housing Works, and then I'm going to repeat a little bit of some of the stuff that Charles talked about, but I'm going to talk about some of the data that supports housing as an essential intervention for HIV prevention and care. Every month, it seems like every time we turn around, we have new study after new study after new study that keeps telling us what we in this room know, that housing saves lives. There we go. So, again, I work for Housing Works in New York City. Housing Works has been around since about 1990, very grassroots. It spun off of ACT UP. Most of you probably have heard of ACT UP. We still have ACT UP in our culture. We ACT UP a lot at Housing Works. Charles and I have been in jail about 6 times together. He's been in jail a lot more times than that. I've just been with him a few times. We are now the nation's largest, it's hard to believe, minority-controlled provider of housing and supportive services for homeless people living with HIV/AIDS. Our new budgets had our number up, at an unbelievable amount. We have almost 500 employees now. So we're big. We're like anybody else in the nonprofit world. We're struggling, but we somehow miraculously continue to grow. One reason for that, I suppose, is because of our business ventures. We learned the hard way under the Giuliani administration not to be so dependent on government funds. And so we have about 10 thrift stores in New York City that bring in millions of dollars for us. And that way we can be less intimidated by the government when we do stand up to them also. And Mayor Giuliani did not like us. Mayor Giuliani does not like people to stand up to him, and we did that. And he almost put us under. So we thank Mayor Giuliani because we learned a valuable lesson from that experience. So, housing operations. We have the women's housing program. We have the transgender housing program. We have the Staten Island housing program. And we have Stand Up Harlem House. In development, we have a new facility. It's going to be a new facility in about 2 years on Jefferson Avenue in Bushwick, Brooklyn. We have the Keith Kyler House, and we have a residential facility in East New York, Brooklyn. Over 140 units of housing, ranging from congregate to scattered site and from transitional to permanent. All of Housing Works Housing is done from housing first and harm reduction perspective. So those are very important concepts. We'll talk a little bit more about those later. So the Women's Housing Program, it was initiated in 2000. It's a City of New York contract. The stream is from the Fed, Ryan White money. It is transitional housing. We don't like transitional housing, but that's all Ryan White will let you do. So that's why we do transitional housing in this case. This program is for women living with HIV/AIDS who just got out of jail. Often they come to us the same day that they get out of Rikers Island. Almost all of our ladies come from Rikers Island. A few come from upstate, but I'd say 95% of them come to us directly from Rikers the day of release. It originated as a 20-bed scattered site program in East New York, Brooklyn. Anybody familiar with New York City may know that that's not a great part of town. So recently, we collapsed that scattered site program so that we can move into a brand new building. It's in Bed-Stuy, again, maybe not the best part of town, but like so many other neighborhoods, is improving right now. And so we're really, really happy about that, to have that beautiful new building for the ladies who are coming to us out of the correctional setting. Just opened it about 3 or 4 months ago, actually. The transgender housing program. I think she said in my bio, mentioned I did move to New York City actually to start this program. That was over 6 years ago. It is a City of New York program. Again, it's a Ryan White funding stream, so it's transitional. 20 scattered site apartments in the East New York area of Brooklyn, with staff offices at our East New York location, which is at 2640 Pitkin Avenue. We're really proud of this program because, as far as we know, it could be one of the very few programs like this in the whole country, if not the world, because it is specifically for gender-variant folks living with HIV/AIDS. The population, since its inception, has provided services almost exclusively to either African-American or Latina transgender folks that have transitioned from male to female. We've had a few Caucasian folks and had just two or three folks that transition from female to male, but almost exclusively, and you know, the lingo is M to F, or male to female folks of color. And the program's still thriving and doing well. We hope to move it into its own building as soon as we can accumulate the funds for that. The Staten Island program, housing program, is HUD funded, so therefore it can be permanent housing. We like to do permanent housing much more. 20 scattered site apartments with staff offices in the St. George area of Staten Island. And again, if you're familiar with New York City, you might know that St. George is the area down close to the ferry. So that particular thing helps, you know, because of the transportation issue, even though Staten Island acts a lot more like Little Rock than it does Manhattan. And there's not a great public transportation system throughout the island, so that's a bit of a challenge for us. We have apartments all over the island. Our clients have to use the buses to get to the ferry, and then the ferry to get to Manhattan, which is, you know, where everybody gravitates to. Everybody in New York City gravitates to Manhattan. We have difficulty getting this program started. That's a story within itself, because it is a more conservative environment over there. And I had a lot of trouble getting realtors to rent to us because we are, in quotes, an AIDS program. It took us months and months. What it took was finding just that one realtor, and then we were able to grow the program. Stand Up Harlem House, very, very proud of this program. Two newly renovated buildings. It was originally three brownstones in Harlem. We knocked the wall down between two of them that were next to each other, made that into one building. So in that building, we have 11 single units with staff offices on that side of the street. And the other side of the street, we have four family units. It's our first venture in housing families. We have two-bedroom apartments and 2 4-bedroom apartments. This is the original funding for this program was HUD money. And again, so therefore, it can be permanent housing for single adults living with HIV/AIDS. And families where the head of household has HIV/AIDS. This is a complex the funding for this place is complex because we have multiple contracts. We have the federal HUD contract, we have a New York State contract, We have two New York City contracts, one through the Department of Health and one through HASA. HASA is the local agency that provides money or welfare, if you will, for people living with HIV/AIDS. Okay, King Kyler House in East New York. These two programs are not in my portfolio, but they are housing stock and housing works. I just wanted to mention those. What is unique about both of these is that they're co-located with our medical facilities and our ADHCs. So it makes those services very, very convenient for our clients. So, can people living with AIDS, HIV/AIDS, with chronic substance use problems be housed? Housing First or low-demand housing models place persons with substance use and or mental health issues directly into housing without requiring sobriety. You know, that's strictly what we do. That's what most housing providers in New York City do today. There are still some that don't, but I would speculate that most do today. Growing evidence shows that these programs achieve housing and service use outcomes comparable to traditional abstinence-only supportive housing. So definition, housing first, again, putting people into housing first, not requiring them to be housing ready, which almost always means sober. We believe it's almost like a Maslow's hierarchy of needs model. We believe that you've got to start with the most basic thing. You're not going to make much progress with people if you don't house them first. And then we wrap the services around them. We envelop the services around them. Low-demand housing, similar to housing first, but a little different, making participation in services optional rather than a condition of housing. And then harm reduction, I think most of you know what harm reduction is. The quick and easy definition is meeting people where they're at. We shouldn't leave it there. Then it's negotiating a reduction of harm. But we meet them where they're at. We don't require them to be sober. We don't make judgments, and we negotiate a reduction in harm based on their lifestyle and what's going on, not whether or not they're using it. So how do we do it? We strictly enforce our house rules. In our congregate facilities, we have 24-hour security. We have case management for every client that's in our housing facilities. We rigorously teach life skills and adult daily living skills. Home visits is a very, very important component. I can't stress that enough. I struggle with my staff about that all the time. But they have to go into the housing units. They have to visit the clients. They have to make sure that they're not living in dirty conditions and that they're taking care of themselves. I always focus in on the key word. It's supportive housing. That means we do that. We go in. Some people argue that it's an invasion of privacy. You can make that argument, and it's not, a totally baseless argument. But again, I focus in on the word supportive. We owe it to our clients to make sure that they live in good, decent, clean living conditions. We refer all of our clients to ADHC and primary medical care. Every time I do my quality assurance report, I can say that 100% of our clients are engaged in medical care. I'm very, very proud of that. That's, very close to housing in that hierarchy of needs. Obviously, folks with HIV, and everybody has to also qualify for the New York City entitlement, so which is called HASA. So it's not just that they have HIV, they also have to be sick. They have to be symptomatic. Obviously, it's very, very important to get folks engaged in medical care. When things don't go so well, which sometimes they don't, we use behavioral contracts, we have case conferences, and rarely we do evict. Often, probably over 90% of the time, we start the eviction process and use it as a tool, because we can pull the plug anytime on that process, and in New York City, it's a very rigorous process. It takes months and months, and usually when you start that process, it gets folks' attention, and you don't have to evict. We're not in the business of making people homeless, of course. So does it work? Low-demand housing models that enrolled more challenging consumers did not see worse housing outcomes, demonstrating that housing readiness or sobriety is not a good predictor of outcomes. Can we prove it? Oh boy, can we prove it. I just recently attended the fourth, I believe, research summit on HIV housing. We just have a preponderance of evidence that states that we can prove that housing is an essential intervention that saves lives, and government should be interested in, and I know we're interested in, it also saves money. Homelessness and unstable housing are linked to greater HIV risk, inadequate care, poor health outcomes, and early death. Studies also show strong and consistent correlations between improved housing status and reduction in HIV/AIDS risk behaviors, access to medical care, improved health outcomes, savings in taxpayer dollars. It's cheaper to put somebody in an apartment, even in New York City, than it is to pay for repeated emergency room visits and jail stays. Dramatic new evidence shows housing is an effective and cost-saving HIV prevention and healthcare intervention for homeless, unstably housed persons with HIV. I would encourage you guys to go to the National AIDS Housing Coalition's website, and there's many, many, many studies there and references and fact sheets. There's even a PowerPoint presentation that you can just download and use on these issues. I think Charles mentioned this study when he spoke, the CDC comparison of housed and homeless people living with HIV/AIDS. This was a very large-scale study, over 8,000 participants. It was multi-state study of HIV-positive adults. Lack of housing equals greater HIV risk. Homelessness is a significant predictor of greater number of sex partners, sex exchange for money or drugs, unprotected sex with partner of unknown HIV status, all drug and alcohol use variables. Lack of housing equals lack of treatment success. Homeless people living with HIV/AIDS are more likely to delay entry into care and remain outside or marginal to HIV medical care, worse mental, physical, and overall health, more likely to be uninsured, hospitalized, and use the emergency room, lower CD4 counts and less likely to have undetectable viral loads, fewer ever on heart and fewer on heart currently, self-reported heart adherence lower. The CDC Housing and Health Study continued, conducted by the CDC and the HUD-HOPA program, with 630 people living with HIV/AIDS in Baltimore, Chicago, and LA. Half of the group got a HOPA voucher. As housing improved for the group as a whole, so did health outcomes, including 34% reduction in emergency room visits, 21% reduction in hospitalizations, 44% reduction in reported opportunistic infections, 40% reduction in sex trade. I'm going to skip everything on here. It just, the evidence keeps saying the same thing. This is a brand new study. This one is kind of hot off the press. And this study was conducted by the San Francisco Department of Public Health and the University of California at San Francisco. This was a very rigorous scientific study. It's good data. It's not published yet. I'll encourage you guys to email me. I'll say that a couple more times before I'm finished. But anybody that does email me, I'll be glad to provide you with any references here, and also this study when we actually get it in its written form. But this was a body count. They actually did a body count. This was a study of the effect of homelessness on AIDS survival. It was a big study, compared homeless. The end was 641 to non-homeless, 5,917. The bottom line of this study is, and this is an astounding statistic to me, supportive housing reduced mortality in this population by 80%. 80% folks. It just couldn't be clearer. And again, all of these studies, this is good science. This is conducted in the country's most respected universities. So, let's have a headline here. Housing is harm reduction. I'll add to that, housing is health care. Research shows a direct relationship between housing status and risk behaviors among extremely low-income HIV-positive persons with multiple behavioral issues. Homeless or unstably housed persons were 2 to 6 times more likely to use hard drugs, share needles or exchange sex, and stably housed persons with the same personal and service use characteristics. Homeless youth were 4 to 5 times more likely to engage in high-risk drug use than youth in housing, with some adult supervision, and over twice as likely to engage in high-risk sex. Homeless women were 2 to 4 times as likely to have multiple sex partners as housed indigent women, in part due to the effects of physical violence. Harm reduction and other behavioral prevention interventions are much less effective for participants who lack stable housing. So this leads me to the International Declaration on Poverty, Homelessness, and HIV/AIDS. There is an international movement now. I'm going to pass these out. And if there are any left, if you can get them back up to the front by me so I can leave them up on the table. We participated in the International AIDS Conference in Mexico City last year. Was it last year? We actually had a conference there on AIDS housing. That was historic. That was unprecedented with those votes. And we delivered this declaration. We had planned to take it to the International AIDS Society's offices protest style, but they got wind of what we were going to do. And they came and accepted it from us. So I'm not going to read it to you. I've just been given my time's up signal. You have it in front of you. The preamble to it, though, is the Article 25 of the United Nations Universal Declaration on Human Rights, which states, among other things, that housing is a basic human right. And I think that's the fire we need to get in our guts. Housing is a basic human right. Healthcare is a basic human right. And the last slide just says simply, and I think I have contact information at the bottom of the declaration. Some things you can do: go to the National AIDS Coalition's website. You can join the International AIDS Housing Roundtable, or you can email me, even if you forget everything else. Email me, and I can give it all to you again. Okay? Thank you very much.
Thank you. Okay, I'm going to try to close this here. We're going to end the program or the workshop today with Clifford Williams, and he's going to give us the valuable consumer perspective of someone who's been involved in the shelter and the homeless system and so forth.
Good morning, everyone. We can sit here and we can talk about homelessness as, and we can call in all the gurus of government and sciences, but yet housing is the greatest unmet service for people living with HIV and AIDS. We can show numbers, bring together great masses of people, both affected and infected, in protest. We have allowed the virus to go from epidemic to pandemic and blame the behaviors of people infected. Researchers perform studies. Their findings clearly show evidence that housing-based intervention works. We can talk here today about homelessness being one of the risk factors for both infection and reinfection. Homelessness puts people in the crosshairs of situations. Homelessness for some creates instabilities in our faculties of well-being, mentally and spiritually. To a person without a home, they have no base of action. Homelessness, for some, leads them to the environment that most times is often infested with drugs, risk, and greater risk of comorbidities. Studies have shown marked changes in the lessening of the risk due to less exposure to external risk factors and more introduction to protective factors. Housing status predicts HIV risk. Research shows a direct relationship between homelessness and high-risk behavior. The lack of stable housing only equals lack of treatment success. We can look at homelessness as merely a symptom of underlying untreated unsolved problems, such as mental health issues, physical issues, lack of education, unemployment. These conditions progress to the point where an individual cannot obtain or maintain a stable living situation. It should be emphasized that the ability of some persons with HIV/AIDS to obtain or maintain adequate housing or to cope with any of the problems associated with HIV/AIDS is not always solely dependent on a given individual's competence. In some cases, the disability criteria or for benefits, housing, or social services are rules of exclusion. In my experience being in the shelter system, I had a very tough time. I had a tough time with their rules. It's like hard to begin to find out where to begin because it's been over time. And I felt like they didn't support anything that I was doing to rebuild myself. They implemented their programs and they wanted you to go by their plans, which I completed Teach Outside, I completed an environmental maintenance course. I've had, you know, other things that I was doing, you know, other than to improve myself, to improve my living situation. And they just made it hard for me. I have I suffer from depression and PTSD. And they, you know, made it hard for me to make my appointments because they had rules that you had to be in attendance for community meetings every day and stuff like that, you know. And I also had a problem with my wife had, she was HIV positive. She has passed in February, and she was under treatment for chemo and radiation. And so I would try to be in support of her. And basically they told me, worry about yourself, you know. And that went against my beliefs of how I should support someone in my family, even though we were displaced from our home. She has since passed. We went through all the necessary programs to receive housing, couldn't. And I got no support from the shelter system, case management per se, you know. Their main issue was to pay shelter fees and savings. So you pay shelter fees and savings for to stay in a place where they really don't even want you to stand in front of the building. You need cosmetics, and in the tail end of it, you can't even buy a deodorant, you know. You know, so it's like I needed glasses, and I wasn't able to get the glasses, you know, because the end result was I was kicked out because I couldn't pay these shelter fees, and I put a down payment on these glasses and still never got the glasses because, you know, I found myself homeless again, you know. So, you know, and there's, I got loads of incidents, which I'm not even going to go through, you know. It's not about me here to complain, but it's a system that needs to be tweaked and fixed. Fixed is the word, fixed. Because it has to meet the needs of people, homeless people. We are people, we are individuals. And each individual case of its kind may be similar, but it's somewhat different, you know. The kind of problem that I went through was just not getting that listening ear from the case management, number one, you know. Maybe they're burnt out, you know. I try to search my mind to figure out what the problem is, but I can't figure out what the problem is. I know what my problem was, and I know the kind of attention that I needed while I was in the shelter system, and I didn't get it. There's been numerous times that I went in the shelter system and wound up on the pavement with my belongings, or on the pavement without my belongings, because they gave my belongings out to the community, you know. So, you know, it's like I come into a place for services, and what was I getting? I was getting kicked out. My case probably is no different than a lot of cases. But I'm just here to give my point of view on where the shelter system is. I view it, so to speak, as a warehouse of men, and I just can speak of the male shelters. You have people coming in from incarceration. You have people who are displaced from fires. You have people who are displaced because they've been evicted from their homes. You know, and it's like this collage of problems that people come in with. And it's like, are we equipped to facilitate now a large HIV population? Which one of the problems that I faced with being was my anonymity about my HIV status. Medication was a problem. So I opted not to take medication while I was in there because I didn't get the anonymity that I thought I should get with my situation. So, you know, I put off to like, you know, my account probably got down like 290 something, you know, until, you know, I probably had to step out of here to be able to better take care of myself. I stayed on the streets. I stayed in bandos, slept by the Schuylkill River. The programs that are there for people with HIV/AIDS, I can only say that I fell through some big cracks, if I fell through any cracks at all. I fell through some big cracks. The housing situation far as for people living with HIV, why should I have to fall to a status of having AIDS, less than my count, less than 200, before I receive services that would keep me from ever seeing an AIDS diagnosis? I believe that's like, we're just like in the wrong direction with that. And it's some tweaking that the system needs to be done. And, you know, like I said, I lost my wife and we were waiting for housing, you know, and we were due to have housing through ACO, say like in April or May. So now my mission is that I have to do the paperwork all over again, which I've already done the paperwork three times before, and had a problem with the ACO packet where it's been filled out three times before on some expired application, you know, which portions of the packet expire anyway. So, you know, what I'm here to convey to people is that, you know, we have to do some work on, you know, fine-tuning these systems if they are to help people, so people like myself don't fall through the cracks. And there are a lot of people out there who don't even know their status. So what are we going to do when we get the influx of those people coming in and find out, you know, the real numbers of the severity of HIV/AIDS. I do not come to you with, you know, the work like that on the board or whatever. I can only come with my experience. I'm nervous as heck. But I feel that I have to get this out, you know, not just for myself, but for other people just like myself. If it wasn't for people just like myself, I would be probably still on the streets using drugs, you know. If it wasn't for Philadelphia Fighting, the education that I got through Teach Outside, I would, you know, so those were the type of support systems that did help me when the shelter system kind of kicked me to the curb, you know. I can say that I stand, sit here before you not asking for sympathy, but empathy for you to put yourself in my shoes or any of the light shoes that, you know, that we get down to work and devise a system that works for people with HIV/AIDS, well, with HIV, you know, and AIDS. Because people are still dying, but they're dying more so because of the AIDS-related illnesses, not just the virus, you know. But housing is a great prevention tool, and it needs to be implemented, and that's all I have. Thank you.
We've got about 5 minutes. We started a little late because the keynote speaker ran a little late, so we'll blame it on Charles King. But anyway, about 5 minutes. So, anybody questions? Yes. And please, if you could stand up so that we can hear your question and to whom you're directing your question, that would be great.
I have a question for Mr. Williams. I heard about cases of people being thrown out of the shelter for filing a complaint when they were dealing with health crisis and then having their meds thrown away and people getting scarlet fever in the shelters. And I was wondering if you could tell me if that's true or not.
Is that in relation to the shelter system here? Or
yeah.
So I think probably Letty, the teacher, may want
to. No, I want to ask
okay,
Mr.
Williams. Okay.
Well, that did happen to me. I caught scarlet fever in the shelter system. The shelter system is not a germ-friendly environment, and you come in and you have a compromised immune system, you are really like wide open for, you know, different bacteria, diseases, and stuff like that. And I think that was 07, I contracted scarlet fever, and it took me out for probably like 3 weeks. When I returned to the shelter, I wasn't able to obtain my clothing or my medication. I'm not going to name any shelters, but I've been in all of them. I've been in the cafes. I've been, you know, they just like pass you around to, you know, when you are deemed a problem at one, they pass you to another, you know, and that's like their solution. You know, and because I went to, say, like Janie Blackwell, and Janie Blackwell got me put back in the shelter, and, you know, I was like blacklisted after that, you know, and that was like something that happened to me that I was like 2 weeks later after being blacklisted or like ridiculed for, don't say anything to him because he'll go to the politicians, you know, these are what the workers were saying to me, you know. It's like you have to speak up for yourself, but in another case, you know, you're going to face some repercussions, you know, and that's how that is.
And I also want to give Letty an opportunity to respond to this. Letty, did you want to say anything?
I can't respond. I mean, I can't respond to his experience.
Okay, can you talk about the protocol maybe? What's the protocol in the shelter system with people with medications and
the protocol
when they get ill?
We have, actually, if there's an outbreak in the shelter, we work with the Philadelphia Health Management Corporation who manages outbreaks within the shelter. So that's what we have in place. But I really can't speak to his experience because I'm not.
How about medications? What's the deal with
medication management? One of the issues that we do have is if a person is HIV positive, how do you protect them? You know, their privacy to make sure that they are able to take their medications. It depends on what facility you're talking about. In some instances, the staff make sure that they have the medication. And a lot of times people who are HIV positive, and I can't blame them, don't want people to have their medications. It is a shelter. It's not a private room. It's not an apartment where you can, you know, manage your medication. So it is a problem.
All right, gentleman right here in the front.
Yes, my name is Junior Garcia. I want to commend Mr. Williams on voicing out because I probably had similar experiences to him. wouldn't like him. As he was speaking, I was like, it's flashback. I'm right now homeless. I chose right now to go to a recovery house where they take all my money instead of going to the shelter. Because Philadelphia here, I'm saying the truth, the housing thing is totally messed up. You know, I mean, you apply for housing and you look on a waiting list that could last 3 to 4 or 5 years, you know. And that's why there's a lot of people out there that are still homeless. And homelessness leads to incarceration, drug use, for females, prostitution. You know, I mean, that's where it leads. And that's where the HIV comes in, and, you know, that's where everything comes in. That's all.
Thank you for that comment. I think I'm gonna have to end it now because I see people already coming in for the next workshop. But please, I think the speakers will, you know, be happy to stay a few minutes and talk to you all. Thank you very much, and enjoy the rest of the day. Don't forget Jeffrey Cowley. He's gonna be a luncheon speaker.
That was such a good
one. I was so
good.
That's great. He's such a good speaker.
Yeah.
And I don't really want to complain, you know, but I know he's really good at working. He's doing some art, you know, and I don't want to try like
mentality. Yeah.
Maybe I can introduce you to some.
Oh, you recorded it too? Oh, cool.
Thank you.
Thank you. I think I might. Is it still recording? Oh my god.
Yeah, that was so good, honey.